Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Since 9/11, this is every American's nightmare.
People were screaming, fire, fire, and the first thing we all did is to check where the fire was. When I saw that the suspect, he was getting on fire, and I freaked, of course, and without any hesitation, I just jumped over all the seats, and because I was thinking he's trying to blow up the plane.
That's the man who leapt on top of Omar Farouk Abdulmutallab on the Northwest Airlines flight over the weekend. But was Abdulmutallab connected to Al-Qaeda? And what would turn this college-educated child of wealthy parents into a suicide bomber? More questions than answers on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Monday, December 28th. John Hockenberry is actually away until next year, next Monday. He'll be back then. Let's get right to the headlines this morning. We have a message from the Homeland Security Secretary.
Air travel is safe while we work our way through this problem.
That's reassuring words from Janet Napolitano that come after President Obama ordered a review of two of the major components of airline security, how watch lists are created, and the use of screening equipment at airports. In the meantime, you can expect to see security changes at the airport in the weeks ahead, longer, more extensive searches at the checkpoints, and more limited passenger movement while the plane is in the air, especially for passengers flying into the U.S. from abroad. But earlier on The Takeaway, New York Times reporter Mickey Maynard told us the domestic measures are based on unpredictability.
So you may see longer lines in the United States, or you may not. You may have security at the gate in the United States, or you may not.
As for the attempted bomber, Omar Farouk Abdulmutallab, we're learning this morning he was on a British terror watch list after he was refused a student visa there and that he bought the plane ticket to Detroit last week in Ghana. Earlier this morning, I spoke with Ahmed Idris, a BBC reporter in Abuja, Nigeria. I asked him about the family background of Omar Farouk Abdulmutallab.
Omar Farouk Abdulmutallab comes from a large, respectable family in northern Nigeria. He's a son of a wealthy retired banker in Nigeria here. He attended his high school in Lomé and is described as an A student in that institution. And he's fondly called the Pope because of his religious beliefs and his devotion to religion, actually. That's why he's being referred to as the Pope. After his high school in Lomé, he proceeded to England, where he studied engineering at the University College in London, before he started an Arabic course in London and then decided to move on to Yemen.
That was Ahmed Idris, a BBC reporter in Abuja, Nigeria, speaking with us earlier this morning. Thanks, Ahmed. In Iran, a day after police officers opened fire into a crowd of protesters, killing anything from 8 to 15 people, there are reports of further clashes this morning. Relatives of opposition leader Mir Hussein Mousavi say they can't hold a funeral for his nephew, who was among those killed on Sunday, because his body apparently has been stolen from the hospital. A funeral could be another focal point for more protests. Reports say police have tear-gassed opposition supporters outside the hospital this morning. Meanwhile, across the border in Pakistan, a bomb blast has struck a major religious procession in Karachi. At least 20 people have been killed, with another 60 wounded. And here at home, retailers are happy this holiday. Newly released numbers show sales were up 3.5% this year. Online spending was up over 15%, and one of the big sellers, Amazon Kindle. It was the most gifted item in Amazon's history. Looking at the markets, the Dow gets underway at 10,520 with mixed futures. The S&P will open at 1,126 and the NASDAQ at 2,285. So all morning we're asking you, do you feel safe when you fly in an airplane right now? Listener Dave called in, says we've got nothing to fear on the tarmac or off.
I just want to say we're still statistically much more likely to get in an accident before getting on the plane than a terrorist incident occurring on the plane. So, yes, I feel very safe traveling on the plane.
How about you? In light of the foiled terrorist plot on Christmas Day, do you feel safe? And if not, is there something else we could do to make you feel safer? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Coming up, we're going to discuss what we know about the foiled Christmas terror attack with the New York Times' Scott Shane.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning. Over the weekend, federal authorities charged a 23-year-old Nigerian man with trying to blow up a Detroit-bound airliner on Christmas Day. That man, Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab, says he got the chemicals from a bomb expert who has ties to Al-Qaeda. Early this morning, we were joined by Ahmed Idris, a BBC reporter from Abuja, Nigeria. Ahmed spoke with Umar's family, and I asked him for the latest details.
The family issued a statement this morning, which is the first official statement from the family on this case, where they said from very early childhood, Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab got the best parental monitoring they could ever give. And he had never shown any attitude, conduct or association that would give concern to them or any other person, except the fact that when Umar Farouk reported to them that he was abandoning his master's degree program in Dubai to go to Yemen for 7 years of Arabic study, that was when they started, when the alarm bell started ringing in their heads. And immediately the father reported to the U.S. Embassy in Nigeria, the Nigerian intelligence community, and the Saudi Arabian authorities.
Clearly, there must have been something going on that made them suspect that perhaps his, by all reports, very strict religious views had become perhaps excessive, that made them call the U.S. Embassy when he said he was going to Yemen.
Exactly. Umar, at one point, while in Yemen, even before he went to Yemen, and while there, he told them that, look, I don't need your money to pursue my education in Yemen, because the education is free. And the father asked him, if you're going to stay in Yemen for 7 years, by then I'm sure your passport must have expired. Then he told the father that, look, even if the passport expired, I'm definitely going to get a Yemeni passport and I can live with it.
Okay.
And he wanted them to cut ties with him.
Huh. That's Ahmed Idris, BBC reporter from joins us from Abuja, Nigeria. We're also joined by Scott Shane, Washington reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning.
So at that point, when his father spoke with the U.S. Embassy, walk us through what happened after that. Umar's father phoned the American Embassy in Abuja in October.
Yes, exactly. In October, he calls and expresses, I'm told, three things. That his son, he believes, has been radicalized, that he may have been in Yemen or he may be in Yemen, and that, in fact, he's missing. They don't know exactly where he is, and they have concerns about him. And this is sort of an extraordinary thing, to take concerns like this outside the family and to the United States Embassy. What they did was they shared the information within the embassy, where there are representatives of FBI, CIA, Department of Homeland Security, and so on. Then they passed the information on to Washington, where it went into a very large database of 500,000 people who have popped up in one way or another with some suspicious ties or connections, but nothing really solid. And it did not go from that database of 500,000 people to the much smaller databases that require extra screening on flights, or the 4,000 people who are on the no-fly list. They explain that in part because obviously one phone call with no corroborating evidence from any other source and from a family member, it can be something quite alarming, but it also can be a family dispute or a grudge or rumor or gossip, and they don't want to necessarily, interfere with someone's life by preventing them from traveling based on one phone call. So what they had done was actually mark this gentleman's file so that if he ever applied for a visa again, they said, let's do a full investigation. But they didn't pull his existing visa, which allowed him to travel the United States through June of 2010.
How does this differ from the story of the five Muslims from suburban Virginia who, in fact, there was a large investigation and they were followed into Pakistan? Was there something different from what Umar's father told the U.S. Embassy and what the families of those five men told American authorities that made them take more notice of the five men from Virginia?
Well, I think in that case, the fact that these five were Americans and that they had all disappeared together, that indicated some kind of coordinated plot or scheme. In this case, and again, they were Americans, so they could travel freely back in the United States. In this case, you had a guy who was Nigerian, and no one knew where he was. That, you know, there was no reason to believe, there was no evidence that he was in the United States at that point, and of course he wasn't. So, you know, we sort of, with hindsight, we look back at this and focus on this one case. Of course, you know, you have to think about how many calls were made to U.S. embassies around the world by family members expressing concern about one person in their family, and of course, so this goes a little bit into the pile of business to think about maybe down the road if more information comes up.
Ahmed Idris from Abuja, Nigeria, can you tell us a little bit about people who may have known him from his master's degree program in Dubai? Have we learned anything about what transformed him to make him want to leave that program and go to Yemen for, I guess, reportedly, Al-Qaeda training?
Well, nothing much. However, I think the issue started when he started his Arabic program in London. This is not confirmed yet, but again, when he started telling his parents that he wanted to leave for an Arab country to pursue an Arabic education, and the parents thought the ideal thing is to take him to Dubai, which is absolutely not on terrorism calendar or whatever. But then they felt that Dubai, being a cosmopolitan city or a country, they feel Umar can get the best education there for his business management, and then again acquire some Arabic as well. But then he said, towards the end of that course, he said, I'm no longer interested in this course. I'm going to Yemen, and I'm going there for 7 years. I think probably if there is some radicalization, it must have started earlier before he left for Yemen.
Okay, that's Ahmed Idris, a BBC reporter, joining us from Abuja, Nigeria. Last question for you, Scott. What happens now? He has left the hospital. Where does he go?
Well, he's gone to a prison, and, you know, this is a criminal case, and he has a lawyer now, and he'll prepare for trial down the road. And the larger picture of what happens is that President Obama has, of course, now ordered a review of both the physical screening at checkpoints and the watch listing to understand what went wrong here and whether this kind of episode could be prevented in the future.
Well, Richard Reed, the shoe bomber, made us all remove our shoes, and we're going to have to see what will change in the security lines in light of this particular incident. Scott Shane is a reporter with our partner, the New York Times. Thank you so much, Scott. It is 15 minutes past the hour. Amy Eddings is with us to take a look at some of the hour's top stories.
Hi, Celeste. Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano says investigators are trying to figure out why the suspect in the Christmas Day airplane bombing attempt was allowed on the plane despite being on a terror watch list. When asked if this incident demonstrates a weakness in the air security system, she told NBC's Today Show,
I wouldn't go that far. What I would say is that our system did not work in this instance. No one is happy or satisfied with that. An extensive review is underway.
That review will look at the watch list system and airline security procedures. Relatives of Iranian opposition leader Mir Hussein Mousavi say they can't hold a funeral for his nephew, who was among those killed Sunday, because his body has apparently been stolen from the hospital. A funeral would have been a focal point for more protests. Meanwhile, more violence in Pakistan today. The Associated Press says the death toll in this morning's attack in Karachi has risen to at least 20. And that's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning.
Coming up, the Kindle. Is it the winner in the e-book wars? Do you have one? Do you want one? It was one of the best-selling items over the Christmas holiday. And in fact, Amazon.com sold more Kindle books than they sold actual physical books with pages. What does that mean? We're going to talk about that in a few minutes.
Hey, you want that to go?
Time for some quick news takeouts on stories we're watching this week. President Obama is on vacation in Hawaii. He has not responded personally to Friday's attempted terrorist attack. Instead, the president deployed his press secretary, Robert Gibbs, to respond over the networks.
We added air marshals to flights coming in and out of this country. So certainly steps were taken to assume and plan for the very worst in order to prevent anything from happening in this country.
That's Gibbs on NBC's Meet the Press yesterday. The president himself did not say much. Julie Mason is the White House correspondent for the Washington Examiner. Julie, President Obama said, don't expect to hear from me, and we didn't.
Right, right. right, Celeste. It's true. I think he's going to have to come out and say something. It's such a big travel week, and people are really jittery now. I think they really want to hear from the president and get some reassurance from him. So we might hear something early this week.
Okay, but so far, just Janet Napolitano and Robert Gibbs have come out. But they have been pretty much blanketing the networks.
They have, you know, but it's not the same. It's not the same as hearing from the president. These surrogates, you know, they can come out and say the president is vigorously involved in this issue, but until we hear from him, you know, he's opening himself up to a bit of criticism, but playing golf and basketball and going to the beach, well, people are genuinely scared about this.
Yeah, but nobody was hurt. It was an attempted terrorist attack, right, that was foiled. As you said, people are feeling jittery. Is it really the president's role to be kind of our therapist in chief?
It really is. You know, consoler in chief, absolutely, especially because now we're hearing these reports about the intense security at airports. Everyone's missing their connections, and it seems like a very chaotic scene. So a few reassuring words from the president, I think, would go far.
And it will make Julie Mason feel a lot better about getting on that plane, right? Julie Mason,
indeed.
White House correspondent for the Washington Examiner. Now let's talk a little bit about what people were buying over the holidays. Jane Sassine is a writer for Business Week. So, Jane, we've been getting these numbers out of Amazon.com. It turns out the Kindle was the most gifted item on Amazon, and it was also sold more Kindle books than regular books. So does that mean Kindle wins in the war of electronic readers? Which platform is gonna come ahead? Does Kindle win?
Well, they're definitely doing very well right now, and you know, you have to their experience compared to the Nook, which was the new reader that Barnes & Noble just came out with on Christmas Day, as you said. There were more e-books downloaded by Kindle than any other day in history, and more than any, you know, real books sold, whereas Barnes & Noble, they weren't able to function well, and so their servers crashed, and you couldn't actually order a book there. So certainly for right now, they're doing very well, but it's very early on in this battle because there are actually more... For the iPod, more people have downloaded an e-reader app over the last year as well. I think it's actually the most downloaded application for iPod. So, you know, people can use that to do the same thing, and they don't necessarily need a whole separate device.
But that's a very small screen as opposed to the Kindle, where it's very easy to read everything. What does this mean about, I assume that this is going to have implications for libraries as we move toward e-books, but the one winner in this equation could be newspapers.
Well, it's interesting because a lot of newspapers are turning towards these devices, but they, like magazines, they don't want to have the same problem that the music industry has had with iTunes, which is, you got one platform that's really dominant, and therefore the pricing is controlled. Like Apple controls the pricing on music, and it's been a real problem for the music industry. So part of what the newspapers and magazines are doing is they're trying to come up with a way of being read on e-readers, but that also can be read on smartphones, on netbooks and whatnot. So they have a lot of different options. And that could be, it's a year or two away, but that could be a real problem for Kindle.
Jane, do you own a Kindle?
I do not.
Oh, so you're not ready to jump on board?
Well, precisely, because one thing you got to also know is, as a real competitive threat to them, is there's been a lot of rumors for the last year that Apple is going to come out with what's called a tablet, which is a larger, essentially a version of, it's like an iPod, but four times bigger. Now imagine that as an e-reader. It's got the color screen we all love. It's got the touch screen and whatnot.
Right.
It's got a lot more flexibility. You can read a book on it. You can read a magazine that actually, theory, looks like a magazine.
And, and the automatic Mac cool factor, right? That's
exactly,
Jane Sassine,
exactly,
a writer for Business Week. Let's move on to sports now with our sports contributor, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. Good morning, Ibrahim.
Good morning.
The party is over. The Indianapolis Colts no longer undefeated.
And so that will do it. Sanchez takes a knee. The clock winds and it's over. The Jets come to Indianapolis. They end the Colts' undefeated season. 14-1 now the Colts. 8-7 are the Jets.
Are those boos we're hitting in the background?
There were boos because the Indianapolis faithful were not happy to see their team go down. They wanted to see them have an undefeated season and join the New England Patriots of 2007 and the 1972 Miami Dolphins. Now, the Dolphins are still the only team that ever went undefeated. The 72 Dolphins, they went undefeated and then won the Super Bowl. The Patriots were the only team that ever went undefeated besides the Dolphins in the regular season. The Indianapolis Colts go down, and the sad part about it is that Peyton Manning had to watch most of it after they had a 15-10 lead. He had to watch most of the loss. The Jets scored unanswered points and took the lead. He had to watch the loss from the sidelines. He didn't look happy.
Yeah, the Jets won 29-15 yesterday. They after Peyton Manning sent out the Colts never scored again. So let's move on from Peyton Manning, the quarterback, to coaching. Urban Meyer, what is the impact of him leaving? Well, what are we talking about, this impact on the coaching world with the story with Urban Meyer?
I think the biggest impact is similar to the way the concussion story hit the NFL. So in the NFL, you heard about concussions, and it changed the way people are thinking about how are people dealing with players that are getting blunt trauma to the head. Well, coaches take an incredible amount of abuse just being coaches. They spend all of their time focusing on recruiting, looking at tape, coaching their staff. They have very little time to actually be human beings, and mostly what the doctors are saying to him is he needs to take a break. And that's why he said it's either all or nothing. Either I coach or I just resign. And so initially he resigned.
Right.
And then the athletic director said, listen, take a leave of absence. Really what it is for Urban Meyer is Urban Meyer has built one of the most successful football programs in the history of college football. He needs to take a break.
Okay, well, better luck to him in the future in getting his stress levels down.
Indeed.
Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, the Takeaway Sports Contributor, thanks so much. Coming up, we're going to look at the agenda with Raihan Salam and the BBC's Rob Watson. Iran, Pakistan, healthcare, terrorism, they're all on the agenda. Just a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, more details about the attempted terrorist attack on Christmas Day. There's protests going on in Iran and more violence in Pakistan. A lot to keep track of, and we're going to try and help you with the agenda coming up in a few minutes. But first, here's some of the news stories we're following at 30 minutes after the hour with Amy Eddings.
The man charged with trying to blow up a U.S. airliner over Detroit on Christmas Day was on a U.K. watch list and had been barred from entering Britain earlier this year. Homeland Secretary Alan Johnson says Umar Farouk Abdul-Muttalib had tried to apply for a visa to study at a bogus college. Speaking earlier on The Takeaway, the BBC's Ahmed Idris in Abuja, Nigeria, explained what the family said in their first official statement this morning.
From very early childhood, Umar Farouk Abdul-Muttalib got the best parental monitoring they could ever give. And he had never shown any attitude, conduct, or association that would give concern to them.
In the meantime, expect to see security changes at the airport, longer, more extensive searches at checkpoints, and more limited passenger movement when the plane is in the air. In Iran, no funeral today for the nephew of opposition leader Mir Hussein Mousavi. Relatives say Ali Mousavi's body is missing. Earlier, we spoke to an anti-government protester in Tehran who calls himself Akbar.
We want the freedom of prisoners, we want the end of the clampdown on the press, and we want the freedom of assembly.
Iranian police have arrested at least 7 prominent anti-government activists. In Pakistan, at least 20 people are dead after a suicide bomber detonated his explosives near a procession of Shiite Muslims in Karachi. They were marking the holy day of Ashura. Relatives made a last-minute plea for mercy for a Briton scheduled to be executed in China for drug smuggling. They say Akmal Sheikh may be mentally ill. Sheikh would be the first citizen of a European country to be put to death in China in half a century. Time for a check on the markets. Asian markets are mixed, but European trading is up. Wall Street futures are up slightly. The Dow gets going in an hour at 10,520. The S&P opens at 1,126. And the NASDAQ opens at 2,285. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Clean energy,
healthcare,
growing our economy,
terrorism in the world today,
putting our people back to work,
no fly list,
doing the work that needs to be done.
It's Monday and there is a lot on the agenda for this week. We've been talking about it all this morning, the attempted terrorist attack from a Nigerian man on a Northwest flight from Amsterdam to Detroit on Friday. Earlier this morning, we were joined by Raihan Salam, a fellow at the New America Foundation and author of Grand New Party, How Republicans Can Win the Working Class and Save the American Dream, and also by Rob Watson from our partner, the BBC. I asked Raihan Salam about the potential political fallout from the attempted terrorist attack by Umar Farouk Abdul-Muttalib.
I think that the Republicans are going to raise the issue in large part because I think a lot of Americans are very concerned about the idea that our Homeland Security officials are asleep at the switch. And I think that there's a lot of concern among conservatives and among liberals that is probably going to take the form of conservatives criticizing the president.
Well, the president has asked for a review of airline security procedures, so I assume we're going to see a tightening in those procedures in the future, but he has going to have to balance that with people's irritation over being delayed as they're trying to get on a flight, right?
Absolutely. The tightening of security procedures that you've already seen is
quite arbitrary. It's not the kind of stuff that really would have stopped this from happening. The truth is that we have a Homeland Security system that is badly broken in its fundamentals. And this kind of cosmetic gesture is only going to create new delays and also batter an already battered aviation sector.
Okay, Rob Watson, let's move on to Iran, where we heard this. That's the sound of massive protests in Tehran, the capital of Iran. So far, we think 10 protesters have been reported killed by the police, including the nephew of the former presidential candidate, Mir Hossein Mousavi. He is confirmed dead. Rob, is that correct?
That is correct, as far as we know. One always has to bear in mind that certainly the BBC, at least, and most foreign broadcasters are not allowed to report on the protests, so one has to be a little bit cautious.
Are protests continuing today, or are they expected to intensify?
It's very difficult to predict, because one has to remember that these protests, which seem to be getting bolder and more direct in turns, are not hugely well structured or organized, in the sense that, as far as one knows, that there isn't a kind of a clear organizing principle. It's not very well put together. It just seems to be largely spontaneous. So difficult to predict. But I mean, if one looks back over the last few months, clearly something is stirring in Iran, and the authorities aren't able to put it back in its box.
Okay. Well, this is all going on at the same time that we are approaching a deadline. December 31st is the deadline that President Obama gave to Iran earlier this year to accept a UN deal to ship their enriched uranium out of the country. Or I guess there's going to be consequences in terms of sanctions. Raihan, if number one, is Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the Iranian president, taking that deadline seriously?
Well, he is certainly saying that he's not taking it seriously. He says that it's totally arbitrary and that he's going to ignore it.
And what happens if he doesn't sign that deal by Thursday?
Well, for the past few weeks, the White House has already been trying to develop a sanctions proposal that is going to gain wide international agreement. Right after the first, the UN Security Council is going to reconstitute itself. And then after that, the White House is going to look for a green light to proceed with some kind of sanctions. And they haven't designed exactly what they're going to be, but they're going to be targeted, they're going to be economic, and the goal is to achieve a wide consensus among U.S. allies.
Okay, Rob Watson, let's move to Pakistan. We're talking about protests and violence in Iran, but the violence continues in Pakistan. It's been going on for some time now. And we got word over the weekend that the militants actually blew up a government official's house that killed him and five others that were in there. And we still have drone attacks going on in northwest Pakistan. In the year ahead, we pretty much have two changes that could happen with the U.S. relationship with Pakistan, right? Either they start to drift away from us, or we get a closer relationship.
You won't mind if I suggest an alternative.
Okay.
a third, which is, you know, the continuation of the extremely difficult relationship alternating between love and hate that's existed really the last few years. I would describe the relationship between the United States and Pakistan as a sort of a marriage, a rather troubled marriage, but both partners need each other. So that's what I would predict for the year ahead. And one suspects that it will continue to be troubled from the West, not just the US's point of perspective, but other Western countries like the UK. I mean, their view is that it will continue to be troubled until the point where Pakistan really does make the decision that the Islamic extremists of all types and sizes on its territory really do represent a fundamental threat to the state of Pakistan, and are not at times a tool that can be used in other aspects of their foreign policy, such as in dealing with India and Pakistan. Until such times as Pakistan has a decent civilian government, I'm afraid that the troubled nature of the marriage continues.
Okay, that's Rob Watson. He's a political correspondent for our partner, the BBC. Raihan, there's one other detail that's kind of hanging over us, and that's healthcare. We kind of thought that once the Senate passed their version, that we wouldn't be hearing about healthcare for a while, right? But they're going into reconciliation now.
Basically, you have a lot of folks among the House Democrats who are saying that we want to make this more affordable. We want to add something like a public option. They probably won't be able to. It's going to probably look a lot like the Senate bill that was passed.
That was Raihan Salam, a fellow at the New America Foundation and author of Grand New Party: How Republicans Can Win the Working Class and Save the American Dream. We're wondering, are you planning to make a significant New Year's resolution this year? I have made one. I'll talk about that in a bit. Maybe it's something you feel you can really stick take two. In our family segment today, we're going to be talking to family takeaway contributor Yolanda Cabanis, and she's going to talk about some of the lessons she's learned during the tough economic year that we've had and how those lessons can lead to a stronger family situation if you make simple, achievable goals for your resolution instead. And maybe you want to change the word from resolution to goal. We're going to talk about that later this hour. We're also asking you if you feel safe when you get onto airplanes during this busy travel time. In light of what occurred on Christmas Day, do you feel safe, or could you feel safer if the government did something else? Let us know at 8778-MY-TAKE, mytake@thetakeaway.org. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee. Well, we still have a 10% unemployment rate across the board in the United States. And for many people, they're turning to their houses of worship to help them find a job. We're joined now by Rabbi Rolando Matalone. He's a rabbi at B'nai Jeshurun Synagogue in New York City. And the rabbi runs a series of programs to try and help his unemployed congregants deal with the stress of joblessness and maybe get them back to work. Good morning, Rabbi.
Good morning.
You just started this program during this particular financial crisis. Why?
Well, we started seeing about a little over a year ago some people lose their jobs and turn to us to say, you know, if you hear of something, or if you hear of someone who had something to offer, please let us know. We started seeing people getting, of course, anxious and concerned about being able to pay their bills and send their kids to school. And so some members of the congregation, as well as my colleagues, I have two rabbi colleagues, and we started figuring out what could we do to help them. And with the help of one of our staff members, Guy Felix Broad, we created what we call an employment task force, created to see what we could do to support members of our community who were either unemployed or underemployed.
And how does it work? People go to their computers and check kind of a community site?
No, it started with trying to assess what people needed. And we convened a group of human resources professionals, a therapist, a social worker, and so on, together with this staff member. And we decided that we heard what people needed. People needed emotional support and spiritual support. And then all sorts of practical support, such as career training, resume writing, interview preparation, and stuff like that, as well as networking. And so we started organizing in different ways to help people in those particular areas.
Rabbi, you talked about emotional and spiritual support. What lessons does the Torah have for your congregants about being unemployed and the stress of that?
Well, so there are several resources. Number one, one is, of course, to maintain hope, and one's hope and one's vision, one's strength. The other one is community and the value of community to be able to turn to one's community for support. And so we started opening some of those resources for people. People fearing, feeling anxious and feeling hopeless, and as well as isolated. People are spending a lot of time at home alone on their computer trying to look for jobs. And that isolated people made them feel ashamed also and guilty that they were not able to provide for themselves and their families. And so we started turning to all sorts of resources, emotional resources, spiritual resources, and try to help them, as well as I said, as a community, which is, you know, the community is there not just to pray together and to celebrate together, but also to support each other at times of need. Okay. And that's exactly what we did.
Well, good luck with that program. That's Rabbi Rolando Matalone of the B'nai Jeshurun Synagogue in New York City. Coming up, making good family resolutions for the new year. But first, it's 47 minutes past the hour. Let's take a look at the headlines. In Iran, a Reuters news agency reporter in the capital, Tehran, says police fired tear gas this morning to disperse supporters of opposition leader Mir Hossein Mousavi. They'd gathered to express their condolences over the death of Mousavi's nephew in an anti-government rally yesterday. Earlier, we spoke to an anti-government protester in Tehran. He calls himself Akbar. I asked him to tell me about the protests.
Good morning.
Can you tell us about these protests and what it looks like in Tehran?
Yes, the protests were very severe yesterday. They all began on last Monday at the funeral of Hossein Ali Montazeri.
And have they intensified, do you think?
They have intensified yesterday on a 10-mile stretch of road on Enghelab Square and on Valley Astras. There were actual skirmishes, and we took some of these squad cars to task. We took some of the policemen out of it and then beat them up, and then we started fighting the militias in spite of the fact we weren't armed.
Okay, you started beating up the police. Has the police become more violent in response?
They become violent, they have guns, they're shooting into people at random.
And what do you think is going to be the reaction to the killing of Mir Hossein Mousavi's nephew?
We're going to fight to the finish. We want the freedom of prisoners, activists, journalists.
And what is that what you want? You want the freedom of these prisoners? That's what you're mainly protesting for?
We want the freedom of prisoners, we want the end of the clampdown on the press, and we want the freedom of assembly.
Okay, that is Akbar, an anti-government protester in Tehran, Iran, where more protests are expected today. Thanks for joining us this morning. And here's Amy Eddings with other news we're following.
President Obama has ordered a review of the two major aspects of the nation's airline security system after the terror incident near Detroit on Christmas Day. Investigators will look at the creation of watch lists and the use of detection equipment at airports. White House spokesman Robert Gibbs says there's one major question.
Why an individual with the chemical explosive that he had on him could get onto an airliner in Amsterdam and fly into this country. So a listing review and a detection capabilities review so that we can look going forward about what has happened now in the past.
Authorities are introducing what they say will be unpredictable security checks. Some passengers can expect longer delays, others will see no difference. More violence in Pakistan today. At least 20 people were killed in a suicide bomb attack on a Shiite Muslim procession in Karachi. And back home, the 3D extravaganza Avatar ruled the box office for a second weekend, earning $75 million. The estimated $278 million gross broke the previous record for a weekend at the movies. And that's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning.
Pull out of the shadows and find that eventually. There we are and what we are is still a family.
On Mondays, we talk about family living, and this is the Monday after Christmas. It's also the Monday before New Year's. So we have Yolanda Cavanis. She's a family and parenting journalist with us today, and you're here to talk about resolutions. But Yolanda, here's the thing. For the past few years, all I've been hearing about is how bad New Year's resolutions are, that we set ourselves up for failure, that the motivation isn't really there, that this false idea of the new year doesn't help us actually follow through.
I feel you. I think the problem has been traditionally we set our goals too high. They're too unrealistic. We want to make these life-altering changes in the first few months of the new year, and we set ourselves up for failure, really. So what I'm proposing is really just minor tweaks, just minor shifts to the left or to the right, because all those little changes will add up to a big change, and especially when it comes to your family. I mean, if you just do one small thing like maybe reduce the level of screaming in your household, there you've increased the peace by just one little small measure, you know? And that's one of my goals. I'm trying to make sure that I've got some space between the time something happens and the time that I react to it. Because, I mean, I've been reading, you've probably seen the articles too. Screaming, they say, is the new hitting. Everybody's going off.
Well, let's talk to one person who's making a resolution, also motivated by family. Andrea Price, good morning.
Good morning.
You have two kids.
That's right. I have a 5-year-old and a 3-year-old, a girl and a boy.
And you've decided you're going to become more organized this year.
Right. Let me just preface all this by saying that I prefer to use the term New Year's goals rather than resolutions, and I feel that they're made to be broken.
So you are literally setting yourself up for failure.
No, I'm not setting myself up for failure, but I'm allowing myself, you know, incremental success, and I will count that as success. So I don't have to completely accomplish my goal, but if I'm working toward it and like she said, making some minor changes and tweaks, you know, I will see that as a modicum of success.
Andrea, are you one of those people that makes resolutions? Have you done so in the past?
I'm not a big resolution maker. I sort of try and look at it in terms of, you know, just changes that are going to enhance my life, because I do feel like if I set this huge, lofty resolution goal, that I am setting myself up for failure. So I tend to, you know, just have smaller ideas in my head of what I want to accomplish in the next year.
Okay, so Yolanda, you think that Andrea's doing the right thing and she's probably going to see some success.
She said something that resonated with me, and that was, you know, she's going for incremental successes. And I think that's a big, important part of this whole process, because awareness really is part of the success process. When you're aware that there's a problem and you're consciously trying to address that issue, then you're moving in the right direction.
Now, one of the reasons, let's talk about motivation. Andrea, you decided to get more organized for the sake of your family.
That's correct.
And tell me what that will help you do.
I'm an OBGYN physician. I have a pretty busy medical practice. Well, I find myself at the end of the day kind of lingering around the office more than I have to, just trying to catch up on things, get things organized, blah, 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 blah. So my goal is to sort of be more effective and more on top of things in my work life, simply to free me up to have stress-free home life where I'm not worried about what's hanging over my head, and I'm 100% focused on my husband and my children and my family, and I'm enjoying that time rather than being worried about what's not done.
Okay, so Yolanda, your typical New Year's resolution, quitting smoking, losing 30 pounds, those are pretty much focused on improving yourself. Yeah. But she's talking about a goal which is focused on making the family stronger.
Right, and which will ultimately make her stronger and happier too, because she's a mom, so she is the cornerstone of her family. And that stress, I can feel that. That stress really translates. When you're at home, you're worried about what's going on at work. When you're at work, you're worried about what's going on at home. I would just take that one step further if I were you, Andrea, and, you know, even if you don't achieve all you want to in getting organized at work, if you make little notes to yourself that these are the things you'll do when you get home. I mean, I've found it tremendously helpful to just take time with each of my kids. And, you know, with small ones, I know that's hard. But, you know, I've got three, and I just am consciously aware of, okay, Chloe and I are going for a walk Saturday at 2. It's 15 minutes maybe. Or, you know, Trinity and I will do X. And those little things, even though I don't know if I'll ever get my work life completely organized. So if I wait for that, I will be a sad puppy. So I think I've got to kind of move forward.
We don't want Yolanda to be a sad puppy.
We don't want that.
Andrea, you know, sometimes these goals that involve family members are the hardest to do because you can't control what your family members are doing.
Yeah, that's correct. You can't necessarily control what your family members are doing, and you can't control, you know, the little tiny things that come up. So the other New Year's resolution is to sometimes you just got to learn to let go a little bit. And, you know, I have to realize that sometimes by definition being more successful in my business means that it will take me away from my family. So I'm only aiming to be, but, you know, so successful in the larger sense, because I don't want it to get to the point where it's overwhelming what's going on in my household.
Well, Andrea, good luck in the year ahead. We're going to have to check in with you in 6 months and see how you're doing. Yolanda Cavaness, our family contributor and parenting journalist, thanks so much for joining us as well. All morning long, we've been asking you, do you feel safe when you're flying in an airplane now? Troy from North Dakota called in to say that maybe a little fear is a good thing for air travelers.
I don't think people feel safe, and in a way, I think that's a good thing, because proven by this last incident, somebody, you know, rose to the occasion to take the bad guy down. And it may sound silly, but if you fly, expect the worst and be ready to help take the bad dude out.
Does that include somebody who's, like, snoring next to me? I'm not really sure. How about you? Do you feel safe? And is there anything we could do to make you feel safer? Let us know at 8778-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Here's your takeaway.
We want to make these life-altering changes in the first few months of the new year, and we set ourselves up for failure, really. So what I'm proposing is really just minor tweaks, just minor shifts to the left or to the right, because all those little changes will add up to a big change.
That was Takeaway contributor Yolanda Cavaniss talking about New Year's resolutions that you could actually stick to. Tomorrow and all this week, I'm going to be joined by a very special guest, co-host Luke Burbank, former NPR news reporter and host of Too Beautiful to Live.
Celeste, I'm ready to go. I found out the most important thing here, where the coffee machine is.
That's the most important. They'll actually bring you coffee.
My New Year's goal,
nicely,
though, is to drink less coffee. So I'm on the horns of a dilemma.
I'm trying to do that also. But, you know, I figure one cup, like a regular little 8-ounce cup a day is good. That's enough. Okay, well, Luke Burbank is going to be with me for the rest of the week while John Hockenberry is away. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway. In the fallout of the attempted terrorist attack on a Northwest Airlines flight, the president wants a top-to-bottom review of airline security procedures. We already take off our coats and shoes and wait to go through the metal detector. What else will we have to do?
I was sitting there working on my computer right by the gate, and they kicked everyone who was already in the area out of the area, and they made us go through a second round of security that was sort of more intense. And then on the flight itself, annoyingly, you cannot access your carry-on bags 1 hour prior to landing. So, good thing I had a book.
That's a passenger at the San Francisco airport already irritated by heightened security. Everyone wants to know how Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab got explosives on the plane. We want to know how we'll get our laptops on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Monday, December 28th. John Hockenberry is away until next year, next Monday, that is. And in the meantime, we're going to take a look at top stories we're following this morning. There's a lot going on today. That's the sound of suspected Al-Qaeda terrorist in Yemen calling on followers to bomb the enemy. The warning was posted on the internet just 4 days before Omar Farouk Abdulmutallab allegedly tried to blow up a plane on Christmas Day as it landed in Detroit. The suspect was not on the no-fly list, even though his family went to the U.S. Embassy in Nigeria to say they were concerned about his extremist views. Earlier on The Takeaway, Scott Shane of the New York Times explained why he wasn't on the list.
One phone call with no corroborating evidence from any other source, it can be something quite alarming, but it also can be, a family dispute or a grudge.
We're also learning this morning that Abdulmutallab was on the British watch list as well, and he was a student at Dubai University where he took classes for 7 months. In the meantime, expect to see some security changes at the airport, longer, more extensive searches at those checkpoints, and more limited passenger movement while the plane is in the air. We're joined now by Paul Piller. He's the Director of Studies for the Security Studies Program at Georgetown University. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning.
So let me ask you, did we actually loosen security after we heard complaints from too many people about being detained at airports?
Yes, these things go in cycles. Officials respond to whatever the latest recriminations are. And you may recall we even had incidents in the past in which the likes of the late Senator Kennedy had their travels interfered with because a name was similar to some Irish terrorist. So, yes, that's exactly the way this operates.
His name was similar to an Irish terrorist. What you're talking about is when they get on particular watch lists, and Farouk Abdulmutallab was on the TIDE list. So what happens when a name gets onto the Homeland Security screening list? Where does that name go then?
Well, that so-called TIDE list, the one with about 500,000 names, that's basically a common database where all U.S. government agencies, the intelligence community, the Department of Homeland Security, the Department of Justice, and everyone has access to it. And as Scott Shane already explained to you, all it takes is the slightest little tip, whether it has any substance or not, to put somebody on that list.
Okay, Paul Piller, stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment. But first, everything else in the news headlines in Iran. Security forces have stepped up their crackdown on the reform movement by rounding up at least 7 prominent anti-government activists. That comes a day after between 8 and 15 protesters were killed in street clashes. Also across the border in Pakistan, a bomb blast struck a major religious procession in Karachi. At least 20 people have been killed and another 60 wounded. When the markets this morning, Wall Street futures are up. The Dow gets underway at 10,520, the S&P at 1,126, and the Nasdaq will open at 2,285. 2005. When it comes to national security, was this the decade that was the best or worst of times? We're going to talk about a decade of homeland security with George Packer later on. And as details are emerging of the attempted terrorist plot on Christmas, we're wondering how you feel about your plane flights. Are you feeling safe going to the airport? Or are there more things that we should do in terms of security? Let us know at 8778-MYTAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. We're going to talk more about that attempted terrorist plot in just a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
In light of the alleged terrorist attack on Friday on Christmas Day, many people had the same question. If this man was on a watch list somewhere, how did he get onto a plane with explosives? Well, Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano answers that.
I think it's important for the public to know there are different types of databases, and there was simply throughout the law enforcement community never information that would put this individual on a no-fly list or a selectee list.
We're getting more details about what happened on Christmas Day, and here to give us more is Mickey Maynard. She's a senior business correspondent for the New York Times. One thing that many people are saying for sure, Mickey, is that the line on the security checkpoint at the airport is going to get longer.
Well, it's definitely true for flights leaving countries outside the United States and headed for the United States. But one of the things that the TSA, which is the security agency, said was that they want travel to be unpredictable. So you may see longer lines in the United States, or you may not. You may have security at the gate in the United States, or you may not. But for sure overseas, Celeste, it will be a tougher time to travel.
So what do we know about what might change on these international flights?
Well, you're going to undergo two sets of checks. Now, at many international airports, you already did that. I found international security to be much tougher than what we've had on domestic flights. But for sure, you'll undergo a bag search and a physical search at the security check-in. And then people were telling us yesterday that right outside the gates in places like Heathrow and Paris and Narita, they're setting up these new checkpoints where your carry-on will be thoroughly searched. People were telling us they're taking everything out of their carry-on bags, and then there'll be a pat-down. Then there are also security measures when you're sitting on the plane.
Wow, well, that's Mickey Maynard. She covers this story for our partner, the New York Times, and is talking about new security procedures in light of the alleged terrorist attack attempted terrorist attack on Christmas Day. We're joined again by Paul Piller, visiting professor at Georgetown University and director of studies for the Security Studies Program there. Paul, let's talk a little bit more about this list that Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab was on. His father, as far as we know, called the U.S. Embassy in Nigeria, talked to them about concerns he had that his son was becoming an extremist and cutting ties with the family and flying to Yemen, and that it placed Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab on this TIDE list, which is a low concern list, as far as I know.
Well, it can be low concern, high concern. Basically, it's anything where there was any kind of tip, any kind of report, anything that brings someone's name to the fore, in this case, expression of parental concern. We have to realize we're dealing in hindsight here. And in retrospect, the tip from the father probably was no more of concern, nothing about it that caused it to stand out from the literally thousands of reports that come into the National Counterterrorism Center that causes people to be put on this TIDE list.
And that's pretty much what Janet Napolitano, Homeland Security Secretary, said.
When he presented himself to fly, he was on a TIDE list. What a TIDE list simply says is his name had come up somewhere, somehow. But the no-fly and selectee lists require that there be specific, what we call derogatory information, and that was not available throughout the law enforcement community.
So Paul Piller of Georgetown University, what moves somebody off the TIDE list to what she's talking about, these no-fly or selectee lists? We've heard that he was on the list in Britain, and then he was going to Yemen. Does anything in his background say he should have been moved?
Well, what moves somebody off that list to something like a no-fly list is more information, corroborating information. You know, the analytic process that people in the intelligence community or Department of Homeland Security are doing every day is piecing together separate pieces of information. When you have something like a single parental tip, it's what we call single-threaded information. Once you have cooperation, more than one thing, then that's basically what causes you to sit up and take notice and leads to a further analysis, a further investigation, which might put you eventually on the 4,000 or so strong list that is actually the no-fly list.
Well, we've heard that Abdulmutallab was going to Yemen to get training, that he possibly was seeking training with Al-Qaeda operatives there. And this is in light of new reports recently over the past week or so of increased attacks against militant camps there and the large Al-Qaeda presence in Yemen. Is Yemen a place where we need to be really worried?
Certainly. The so-called Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which includes Saudis and Yemen, seems to have set up its headquarters there. Yemen is a very unstable country, not only for that reason. They have an active rebellion in the north. They have an incipient secessionist movement in the south. And when we talk about unstable countries that are areas of concern, Yemen goes right to the top of the list. And we've already near the top of the list. And we've already seen specific U.S.-Yemeni cooperation with regard to the information sharing that led to these armed attacks against the militant sites that were reported within the last week or so.
Paul, let's ask about whether or not this system is broken. Is this particular indication a sign that the system is broken? Or as we heard from White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs, is this a sign that everything was working as it should because the terrorist attack was foiled?
Well, it's neither broken on the one hand nor everything's operating as it should. Systems like this get tweaked all the time. Surely the Obama administration is going to tweak this system, which was set up during the previous administration. There are inherent limits in terms of what you can do, the main limit being the sheer volume of information, the reason you do have 500,000 entries on that TIDE list. So there will be tweaks, but I would not describe it as broken.
But Paul Piller of Georgetown University, we have had a lot of reports in recent days of this particular foiled attempt. We talked about the five Muslim men who left Virginia for Pakistan, which authorities seemed to be right on top of. Aren't these reports signs that the law enforcement community is doing its job?
The law enforcement community is doing their job, and all these reports are a reminder that we're always subject to threat or danger from individuals who become radicalized on their own. It's not just a matter of defeating one group.
Paul Piller, Director of Studies for the Security Studies Program at Georgetown University. We were also joined by Mickey Maynard from our partner, The New York Times. Thanks to both of you. It's 15 minutes past the hour now. Let's take a look at the headlines.
All morning, we've been talking about the alleged attempt to blow up a Northwest Airlines plane bound for Detroit on Christmas Day. We're getting a few more details this morning. The man's family back in Nigeria released its first official statement. The family said their son's behavior was completely out of character. Speaking to us earlier this morning, the BBC's correspondent in Nigeria, Ahmed Idris, told us more of what the family said.
From very early childhood, Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab got the best parental monitoring they could ever give. And he had never shown any attitude, conduct, or association that would give concern to them.
The suspect has been released from a Michigan hospital and is now in a federal detention center. He faces charges of attempting to destroy an aircraft. More violence in Pakistan today. At least 20 people were killed in a suicide bomb attack on a Shiite Muslim procession in Karachi. And a new poll by the Pew Research Center has found that Mississippi is the most religious state in the nation. The next on the list is Louisiana, the least religious the state of Maine. And that's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning.
We all know President Obama has a lot of issues to juggle when he heads into the office every morning, except right now he's on vacation in Hawaii. And we're going to ask noted historians whether or not this president is taking on more tasks in his first year in office than other presidents before him. That's coming up in just a few minutes. Good morning. So let's look back at the year real quickly. We've got two wars going on, the troop surge forthcoming in Afghanistan, plus we're trying to exit Iraq at this point. We've got a 10% unemployment rate. We've got climate change in Copenhagen. We've got the largest debate perhaps in American history on health care reform. And don't forget the economic recession, which is still with us. That's a lot of issues to tackle in your first year on the job. And to give us some perspective on this, we have two historians. Philip Blom is a journalist and author of The Vertigo Years. He joins us from Vienna, Austria. And Jay Winnick is historian and author of the bestseller April 1865, The Month That Saved America. He joins us from Maryland. Good morning.
Good morning. here.
So let me go one at a time. Philip, let's start with you. This past year that we've had, put this in perspective for us. Has any other American president had this many major issues in their first year?
Well, I'm not an expert on American history. I wouldn't dare to comment on that. But I think Obama is trying to take America a new way, and I think that makes it an exceptionally challenging presidency. And also, and I must say that that impresses people very much in Europe, he is trying to realize that we are all facing issues that are global, and you can no longer go it alone, not even if you're the most powerful nation on earth. We need to pull together. And, you know, I think every course change of a huge vessel like a huge state just takes its time.
Okay, well, Jay Winnick, let's ask you, how exceptional is this first year for Barack Obama?
You know, it is exceptional, and it's exceptional in the fact that let's not forget, and history can't forget, that we had this really remarkable spectacle of a black man of both Christian and Muslim descent who took the oath of office on a Bible from Lincoln. And really, almost by definition, his first year is historic. But in terms of how packed his year is, in many ways it calls to mind both FDR, who had a flurry of activity and where the scope and scale of his ambitions were really quite large and desperately needed, and also of LBJ, who had to wrestle with a war abroad and who ushered in the Great Society at home. What we don't know yet is will this year be seen as a success or not a success, and only time will tell there.
Well, let's hear from President Obama at what he thinks is successful about this year.
This will help millions of people and end up being the most significant piece of domestic legislation, at least since Medicare and maybe since Social Security.
Jay Winnick, that is President Obama talking about the health care reform bills passed in both the House and the Senate. What do you think? Is he right? Is this going to be landmark legislation?
Well, I think it certainly will be landmark legislation. Again, only the long reach of history, 5, 10, 15 years, will kind of give a fuller report card on is this deemed a successful legislation or unsuccessful. But I think the fact that it's going to extend health care to so many more people, that this is really a kind of transformative piece of legislation, will be seen as really significant over time.
Philip Blum, the other thing obviously going on, one of the other things going on right now is, as I said, the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And I'm wondering, you live in Europe. Has the reputation of Barack Obama changed over this past first year than when he came into office and became such a popular president worldwide?
I think people have sobered up about him. And, you know, there have been some people disappointed because he didn't turn out to be Father Christmas and deliver all promises at once. But I think, you know, the assessment of him has become more sober in seeing that he is presiding over a nation that has its own interests and that he has to take these at heart, and that in fighting a war, there are no good options. You can't be the good guy all the time. And you can't just do what people would like, namely ending this war perfectly, taking your troops out and making the Afghans happy and the world safe. That is just not on the menu. And I think that has led to a certain kind of soberness over here.
Jay Winnick, do wartime presidents historically get a pass on certain things?
Well, I think they certainly do get a pass. But one can't underestimate just the kind of difficulties and challenges of being a wartime president. You know, I've always been struck or almost even haunted by the image of Abraham Lincoln as late as 1864, which was 3 years into the Civil War, and he was sort of walking through the halls of the White House, his head put down, and he was moaning, "I must have relief from this anxiety or it will kill me," because he thought the war was going to potentially even be lost. But a year later, he became the president who won the Civil War, who saved the Union, who freed the slaves. And what we really see throughout history is that wartime presidents, it's as great a challenge as they can possibly face. The same thing happened with FDR, for example. We also saw the same thing with LBJ, who was undone by the war. Over the weekend, when we had this terrorism incident, we see that's one of the great wild cards. And Obama will have to become, in many ways, a traditional foreign policy president. Remember, George W. Bush, he campaigned on humility in foreign policy, 9/11 struck, and, of course, the rest is history. It's important for Obama how he's perceived in history, that he become that he really become a real foreign policy president.
Philip Blom, does the international community recognize some of these other issues that are so present for Americans? Do they see Obama stepping forward not just on the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, but domestic issues like health care?
Yes, they certainly do. I think there's, as Jay Winnick said, there's a wide recognition that this really is a historic moment, not only for America, but for the world. Not only to have a black man, but to have someone who really tries to tackle very aggressively the agendas that are necessary to tackle. And yes, it's true, time only will tell whether he will be successful. He needs the help of his allies, and he needs the help of his domestic allies, but I think it could be a truly historic presidency.
Okay, that's Philip Blom and Jay Winnick, both historians. Philip Blom, author of The Vertigo Years, Jay Winnick, author of April 1865, The Month That Saved America. Coming up, why do we need to complete the Senate census, and what's with all this really, really weird categories around race this year? We're going to talk about that in a moment.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, if the U.S. Census just counts Americans, why is it so controversial every time it comes around? We're going to talk about that in just a few minutes. But first, here's some of the news stories we're following at 30 minutes after the hour with Amy Eddings.
Thanks, Celeste. Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano says investigators are trying to figure out why Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab was allowed on board a flight from Nigeria to Detroit with just a carry-on bag and explosives hidden on his body. When asked if the foiled Christmas Day bombing attempt shows a weakness in the nation's air security system, she told NBC's Today show,
"I wouldn't go that far. What I would say is that our system did not work in this instance. No one is happy or satisfied with that. An extensive review is underway."
Reuters says airline shares have fallen more than 2% in pre-market trading. More on the markets now. They're slightly up this morning. The Dow is up about 11 points. The S&P is up about 1 point. And the NASDAQ is up about 4 points. These are some of the stories we're following this morning.
The federal government is about to start another census. $400 billion it costs to distribute the census counts. And this week, we're looking all this week into why we need this headcount and why is it so controversial every time the census comes around. That's every 10 years. Who does the census actually end up counting? Why are minority groups routinely undercounted? And how much does the government need to know about us anyway? To start off this week, we're talking to the Census Bureau director himself, Dr. Robert Groves. One of the most controversial portions of this year's census questionnaire is what is not in there, and that's that there's no question about citizenship. Mr. Groves, why did the Census Bureau decide to count both citizens and those who were here illegally?
Well, it wasn't my decision. It's the law, as it turns out. And to understand this, you have to go way back and read the Constitution that says, one, that we will enumerate people in their usual abode, all persons. And then in the 14th Amendment years ago, we agreed that the apportionment of the House of Representatives would be based on a count of all persons, not just citizens. And so we're, as a government agency, follow those laws carefully. And interestingly enough, this is the way we've done a census every decade since 1790. So it was not our decision. And indeed, again, as the Constitution specifies, Congress is directed, is given the responsibility for directing how the census has been taken.
So this is something that's been going on since 1790. Why is there so much controversy over counting these illegal immigrants now?
Well, it's interesting. If you're a student of history, you can see this discussion arising in the society around every census following decades where immigrants have entered the country in rather large numbers. So although we forget about this because 10 years is a long time between censuses, this is a discussion that is common in this society and other societies, actually, that experience such immigration. How to count these different groups is a valid societal debate and properly placed under the Constitution and Congress. So these are proper things to discuss. we will follow the law as specified. I do note that some residency rules, as we call them, pose logistical problems. So on another topic, some say, why don't we count all Americans who live overseas?
Right.
Why not include them in the U.S. Census? And although you can make the argument for that, and I can understand the argument, the logistics of counting all Americans throughout the world ends up being, you know, overwhelmingly complex.
Well, I would imagine the logistics of counting everyone in the United States would be pretty overwhelmingly complex for me.
It is pretty complex. It's complex enough.
I would think. You've changed the descriptions of race in the census, and I was kind of wondering how I would fit in. Let's go over first on what are the categories, because you've split out things like there's a bunch of different categories for Hispanics. You've split those out. And you've got Black, White, and Native Americans as races. Asian is not. So first, let's talk about these categories and how you decided upon them.
We, for many decades, as well as many social scientists, have separated a notion of ethnicity from race. And the ethnic groups that are on the form are Mexican, Mexican-American, Chicano, Puerto Rican, Cuban, other Hispanic, Latino, and other Spanish origin folks. And we remind people, Argentinians, Colombians, Dominicans, Nicaraguans, Salvadorans, and Spaniards to write in exactly how they think of themselves, what phrase describes them. So ethnicity is separate from race. And then the racial categories on the 2010 form are white versus Black, African American versus American Indian or Alaskan Native, and then a large set of Asian groups: Asian Indian, Japanese, Native Hawaiian, Chinese, Korean, Guamanian, Filipino, Vietnamese, Samoan, and then other Asians. It is interesting, as a social scientist, to look at how this country has measured race and ethnicity over the decades. It changes every decade, and it changes in response to changes in the society. So my speculation is this isn't how we'll estimate or record race and ethnicity in 2020, because things will happen over the next 10 years to make it a less than good accounting of the different groups in the population.
Well, Robert Groves, you're the director of the U.S. Census Bureau, so give me a little bit of help here. I'm part African American. I'm part Jewish. Somewhere back in there, I've got Spanish going on, and I've also got Cherokee and Choctaw mixed up in there as well. What box do I fill in?
Well, the wonderful thing about this form is that you can check multiple boxes, those that you identify with and think of yourself as. This is self-reported race and ethnicity, and you're able to report the mix that you see in yourself as you wish.
What if I feel Chicano on that day?
You indeed, if you want to make that
identification,
self-reported, you can do that.
Which seems odd, since that's going to have effects on terms of where my federal dollars go for certain minorities.
Well, what we found in the 2000 census, although we gave people the opportunity to mark multiple boxes, few do it. It's going to be very interesting to see, given the discussion about multiple race folks over this decade, how people behave with regard to that.
This is what I find so fascinating about the census. Every time the census comes around, obviously it's extremely busy. There's a lot of talk about the counting. There's usually controversy about all the topics we just went over. But really, in terms of some of the most interesting things that the census accomplishes, that happens in the shifting of data in the 10 years in between the actual census.
I agree. The payoff of a census is what we learn about ourselves. And I guarantee you, Celeste, if you went back right after the 2000 census, your program and newspapers and the media in general, you could find stories about how the society has changed in 10 years, it's that discussion about ourselves that takes place both, you know, around the kitchen table, but also in social organizations and political affairs that is so important. It always gives us a hint of what we're becoming as well as what we are, and that is the long-lasting value of a census. It shapes our view of ourselves.
I guess that's the takeaway of the entire U.S. Census. Thanks so much, Robert M. Groves, Director of the U.S. Census Bureau. Coming up, when it comes to national security, what was this past decade, the best or the worst of times? We're going to talk about 10 years of Homeland Security with New Yorker staff writer George Packer. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee. That's the sound of violence in Iran's capital of Tehran over the weekend as police reportedly killed somewhere between 8 and 15 protesters yesterday. One of the killed was the nephew of the former presidential candidate Mir Hossein Mousavi. Joining us now is the LA Times Middle East correspondent Borzu Duragahi. He's covering the protests from Beirut. Good morning, Borzu.
Good morning.
What's the latest that we're hearing from Iran? Are protests continuing?
No, we don't have any reports of protests continuing today. We've had a report of a stepped-up crackdown, however, numerous arrests of opposition figures and aides to Mir Hossein Mousavi, as well as human rights activists and so on. And we have a report that the person that you mentioned that was killed, the nephew of Mir Hossein Mousavi, his body has disappeared from the hospital. And this is what many suspect is an attempt by security forces to prevent demonstrations from breaking out with the funeral. No body, no funeral.
Well, is this perhaps an attempt to deny that he was actually killed?
I don't think that anyone's going to deny that he was killed, since the photographs of the body have already showed up on the internet. But this is just an attempt, probably, by shadowy elements within the Iranian security forces to try a move, to try to, you know, stem these protests without probably the adults in charge actually being informed. There's a lot of that in Iran lately, of people in the security forces acting as kind of freelancers, taking on these sorts of duties without going through the proper channel.
Borzu, the United States is one of several countries that have stepped forward to condemn the violent response of the police against protesters in Iran. Number one, are the protesters aware of the international condemnation, and is it adding fuel to the fire?
Well, I think that they are aware of it because they're plugged in and tuned in. I think that it's reassuring to them that, at least to many of the protesters, that the Obama administration is not rushing out to shake President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's hands and try to deal with him on the nuclear issue, which is something they oppose. But they are very wise in terms of not wanting the U.S. to intervene more forcefully either. And so they appreciate the support, but I don't think it has a huge impact on what's going on the ground.
Since you talked about the nuclear issue, there is this December 31st deadline approaching. The Obama administration has asked Iran to sign the deal to ship out their enriched uranium by the end of the year. Do you think Iran will sign the deal?
I don't think that they're going to sign the deal, but I also think that the Obama administration worked in enough wiggle room in that language, in that wording of a deadline by the end of the year. They have the political option to extend and the flexibility to make another counterproposal if they so decide based on their political calculations.
Well, maybe he will give them some more time. That's Borzu Duragahi, the Middle East correspondent for the LA Times, speaking to us from Beirut about protests over the weekend in which somewhere between 8 and 15 protesters were killed by government forces. Coming up, a look at the past decade through the eyes of a Homeland Security expert. That conversation in just a few minutes. But first, here's Amy Eddings with other news we're following this morning.
Good morning. A message this morning from the Homeland Security Secretary.
Air travel is safe while we work our way through this problem.
Janet Napolitano's reassuring words on NBC's Today Show come after President Obama ordered a review of watch lists and airport screening measures. Airline passengers face new scrutiny, including more thorough bag searches and more pat-downs. Already dozens of flights from Canada to the U.S. have been canceled because of longer wait times. France no longer has the fastest train in the world. China now holds the distinction with a train that averages 217 miles per hour. These are some of the headlines we are following this morning.
Everybody reacted as they should. We trained for this. We planned for this. We exercised for this sort of event.
That's Janet Napolitano, the Homeland Security Secretary, talking about the attempted terrorist plot from Christmas Day. She says everything went as it should. We're joined now by Bruce Hoffman, a terrorism expert and professor of security studies at Georgetown University. Good morning, Bruce.
Good morning.
We heard from both Napolitano and the White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs that things proceeded as they should have done, and this was a sign that the system is working. Do you agree?
Well, it's interesting that the British government flagged this individual's name and put him on a watch list in that country, yet the United States, we were unable or incapable of doing so.
And what should we have done that we did not do?
Well, in essence, we've left the defense of aircraft against terrorist threats to the last and the thinnest line, which was the passengers themselves. Fortunately, tragedy was averted, but I think that that's a very thin reed to base our security on. Firstly, in terms of intelligence, his name should have triggered warnings, not only because his father, who was a respected and known individual in the Nigerian banking community, had warned the United States about him, but also because he paid cash for his ticket, which is also one of the key trigger points that should have generated further alerts. Secondly, that he had what is, after all, military ordnance, a very sophisticated explosive, PETN, that physical security should have also detected. So I see it more as a compound failure.
Well, we'll have to see if airline security strategies change in the weeks ahead. Thank you. That's Bruce Hoffman, terrorism expert and professor of security studies at Georgetown University. Speaking of security, today we kick off a week of looking back at this very, very changing, turbulent-filled decade, areas like technology, culture, and the economy. But we started this week-long conversation with national security.
This just in, you were looking at obviously a very disturbing live shot there. That is the World Trade Center. And
another one just hit. Something else just hit. A very large plane.
America's united. The freedom-loving nations of the world stand by our side.
Today we focus on Afghanistan, but the battle is broader.
Every nation. But it is also crucial that civil liberties in this country be preserved.
A Florida man had a confirmed case of anthrax.
This morning, Richard Reed confessed in open court that he is a member of Al-Qaeda.
An axis of evil.
We got him.
Reprehensible massacre on Madrid commuter trains this morning.
We expressed people at tube stations throughout London were being evacuated.
The Taj Hotel, it is not just a hotel. It is a symbol of Mumbai.
Tomorrow at Fort Hood, we will observe a day of mourning, and we'll move back to normalcy as soon as possible.
And now we must come together to end this war successfully.
Last week, just a few days before the Christmas Day attempted bombing of Flight 253, we called on George Packer for a review of the decade of security news. He's a national security writer for The New Yorker and author of the new book, Interesting Times, Writing from a Turbulent Decade. Before those attacks took place, I asked George Packer to give us a title for this chapter in American security history, from September 11th on through the terror plot since.
I would say America reenters history, because after the Cold War, we thought we sort of had a pass. We could get rich. We could invent wonderful information technology. We could become obsessed with our laptops and our iPods and be left alone by the world, even though we were the only superpower. That was an illusion. And that illusion was destroyed on the morning of September 11th, 2001. And I think since then, we have been dragged back into history, which means into conflict and into the affairs of other countries. Perhaps we were always involved, but we weren't aware of it. And Americans, the mass of Americans, have become conscious of the rest of the world and of our role in it and of the effect of our actions for better and worse in a way that I think we had stopped being for a while after the end of the Cold War. We woke up from a daydream. And in that sense, and only that sense, something good happened on the morning of September 11th, 2001.
You also talk about the way that journalists have covered not only September 11th, but the events that happened after that, how they covered the Bush administration, how they covered privacy among Americans, how they covered the Patriot Act. And in some ways, you saw the global media coverage as poisonous.
I'd say it was the best of times and the worst of times. The worst of times in the sense that, first, I think the Washington Press Corps committed a historic mistake by accepting the Bush administration's case for WMDs in Iraq before the war. But I think it's also been a decade in which American journalism, especially covering foreign stories, has really risen to the occasion, both in newspaper and some radio reporting and also in long-form journalism and in books. And that shows that journalism, although in its business model seems to be on a downward arc in its substance, is actually experiencing something of a golden age in this decade of national security crises.
You know, I'm wondering, George Packer, what your view is of this, because to a certain extent, the war in Iraq, for me as a journalist, was a major come-to-Jesus moment. I mean, that was devastating in terms of how much I felt like we as journalists had let down the country. To a certain extent, I also felt like it was positive because it was such an eye-opener for so many of us.
Well, that's another theme of this decade, and it's in the media, but it's in every other major institution of this country. One by one, every institution in America failed in the Iraq War. It was like a stress test for our democracy, and every organ and system showed that it wasn't up to the challenge of something as big on the scale of a major war and a major occupation. But some institutions began to adapt and to learn. The military adapted and learned faster than any other because they're on the point of the spear. They're the ones who are getting killed. So counterinsurgency, which became almost the gospel of the Army and Marine Corps, was really learned the hard way in the cities and deserts of Iraq by units that were losing a battle against an insurgency they didn't understand. And that shows that some institutions can adapt.
I want to ask you about the future, the next era, because it could be the future of national security could be a number of different things. So there's two that come to mind immediately. And the first one is maybe the next era is about our veterans, because there have been so many problems in how we handle our veterans, whether we take care of them. So perhaps that's one thing that may come in the years ahead. But the other one is the idea of homegrown terrorism as it arises more and more and more. Do you feel like we are blowing that out of proportion?
I don't think that's going to be the major focus of our national security. I think, in a way, what began on September 11, 2001, which is wars of counterterrorism, which led to counterinsurgency, which has created hundreds of thousands of American troops in foreign countries, we're not done with that. That is going to continue for many years, especially in Afghanistan.
What I'm hearing from you, and also the sense that I get from your book, is that, like so many other eras, which were terrible and tragic and rough for Americans, it sounds to me like you feel we've come out of it better than when we entered.
I'm mixed on it. I think we have, in some areas, better leadership than we did before. I think that's true in the military. I think it's also true in our civilian government. But on the other hand, we continue to be a profoundly insular country that has not addressed our own problems and that is fitful in our interest in other countries and our sense of their importance to us. And I sense that whatever curve of internationalism might have followed 9/11 is bending back homeward, and that President Obama will be pushing public opinion as far as he can in order to stay in Afghanistan, because I don't think Americans are capable for extended periods of really wanting to understand what's going on in other countries. It's the nature of our insularity. And I also think that at home we have these gigantic problems that we have begun to address in our politics, but I'm not sure our politics is capable of addressing. So that's where institutional decline is the long-term trend that I think has not been arrested across the board.
That's George Packer, New Yorker staff writer and author of the new book, Interesting Times, Writings from a Turbulent Decade. He's channeling Charles Dickens there, calling the past decade the best of times and the worst of times. Thank you. Tomorrow and all this week, I'm going to be joined by a very special guest in the studio. Luke Burbank will be co-hosting with me.
Well, my reputation precedes me.
Former NPR news reporter and host of Too Beautiful to Live. Good morning, Luke.
Good morning, Celeste. This is very exciting. You have a talented and dedicated staff here.
We do, and they're beautiful also.
They really are. You guys run a tight ship, so I'll try to fit in best as I can.
Well, make sure you're ready for those early morning hours. If you missed anything, we're always on here at The Takeaway. You can take our podcast to go by subscribing at iTunes or at thetakeaway.org. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.